Please plan my getaway. Please. I will do whatever you tell me to do. I will follow the instructions, but I cannot think. I cannot be logically thinking here and planning this out because I am terrified.
You're listening to Alchemical Voices, a podcast exploring the lives of BIPOC, transracial adoptees, and survivors of complex trauma. Hi, I'm Jaslyn, your host, a nurse, and trauma release practitioner, curiously observing the human experience. As a Black woman and survivor of human trafficking, I've encountered many, many hardships. On the road to recovery, I discovered that storytelling unites us at heart and is where we find healing, inspiration, and encouragement. In each episode, you'll hear stories from courageous souls, and we will touch on subjects such as identity confusion, the impacts of racism, complex trauma, transracial adoption, and much more. How do we rise amid trials and tribulations? How do we invite softness into our lives? We touch on these and many other questions, so tune in to experience transformative storytelling and let's heal together. Welcome, everyone, to another episode of the Alchemical Voices podcast. In the studio today is Anna Lopez, and her story and journey is absolutely incredible. I have an absolute warrior goddess in the studio, my friends, and I am so excited that she's here, and I can't wait for you all to just listen to her words of wisdom. Anna, welcome, and thank you for being here.
Jasmine, thank you for having me. It is such an honor to be here and have this conversation with you today.
Yeah. So excited.
I
I still can't get over that you're here and we're really gonna have this conversation.
Guess we are.
Yes, we are. Okay, Anna, would you just like to start by presenting yourself? You've done some amazing things, achieved incredible things. Who are you and what do you do?
So, first things first, it's quite interesting to tell you about who I am in terms of where I grew up and where I'm originally from. So I am originally from India. So my parents are Indian, but they moved to the United Arab Emirates, and that's where I was born, and that's where I reside at the moment. I was an only child growing up. And I went to school here in the UAE. I ended up being a domestic violence victim for a good 6 years and was even exposed to a lot of abuse during my childhood. And having gone through all of that, that's what inspired me to one day say, okay, this is a lot of pain, this is a lot of suffering. I don't know what to do with it. I don't know how to carry on. I don't know if I have what it takes to do this thing called life and if I have the motivation to do it because I'm exhausted. And that's when I saw a glimmer of hope when I thought about turning my pain into purpose, which what we were talking about a little bit earlier. And that kind of gave me this sense of purpose in going forward and saying, okay, I'm going to use this pain to help others, and I'm going to use this pain to tell my story and make a difference. And this is going to help me get through each day. So that's really been where I came from and what inspired me to be where I am today. And I just started off my, a page one day on Instagram, and I was like, I want to call it Brave and Free because it was inspired by my own personal journey where I was brave enough to leave an abusive marriage, and that step of bravery brought freedom. And so I created this page, and it was my space to express whatever I was silenced for so long. And so I created this page, and I shared my story in whatever capacity that I could, whether it was on a podcast, whether it was part of a campaign, I worked for a nonprofit. So I just tried my hand at like every opportunity that I got to help others and advocate for, us complex trauma survivors, and also advocate for the impact of trauma on our mental health. And here I am.
I don't even know what to say. I just feel like, let's go, baby. Let's fucking go. What happened? What happened in your childhood? How on earth did you meet this partner you ended up marrying? What did he do to you? Obviously, I know because I've read it, but please just share whatever you feel comfortable sharing and what you think could help a listener.
So it all started back in 1986 when I was born, and I grew up in a house where my dad was a struggling alcoholic, and when he was under the influence is when he would get violent. So for a good, I'd say 18 years, I was growing up in a space where there was abuse happening on a daily basis. So my dad would drink every day, and the abuse would happen in such a way that it was more so towards my mom. And I would be the child who was stuck in her room, really scared, didn't want to go outside her room because, gosh, it sounded like a war zone out there. And that kind of impacted me in a really bad way. And what I mean by that is that I became really introverted. I began to feel depressed. I had a lot of anxiety. I had a lot of fears. I developed so many inhibitions, whether it was going to school or talking to people or just about anything. I was just a scared little girl. And there was a lot of emotional negligence, or I would say absence, because one, my dad was an alcoholic and he was dealing with his own demons and he had been through his own trauma growing up, which now I understand. And my mom was busy with her work and, focusing on my dad. And so I was just there existing, trying to take care of myself. And trying to survive that space and atmosphere. I think towards my teens, I started dating. I started dating pretty young, and I'm not surprised by that because obviously I was looking for a lot of love and attention. Along the way, there was a situation where I was sexually abused by the watchman of our building because I was the only child. My mom and dad would go to work. And so they didn't want me to be alone at home, or they were scared of me being alone. So they'd rely on like the watchman to come in and check on me. But unfortunately, things didn't go the way they expected. And this entire situation turned into a nightmare where, I was experiencing sexual abuse for, I think, about 2 to 3 years. And that was the first time I actually spoke up to my parents and said, well, this is what happened to me. And that was the first time that I was not believed. And so it was at a very, very young age that I spoke up and I found the strength to speak up and say, this is what happened to me. This man did this to me. And I got told, well, maybe you misunderstood the situation, or maybe he didn't mean to do that. And that really set the stage for me and how I was going to respond to things and situations in the future. And I knew that, okay, there's no point in talking about things that happened to me because no one's going to believe me. I mean, if my parents don't believe me, they don't take me seriously, then who else will? And after that point, I don't think we ever spoke about that topic. It has never come up in our conversations about what did he do to you and what happened there. And that's really strange when I come to think of it. But it's also painful to think that my first experience of abuse was not believed and was left, to kind of fester and grow into something else. About 18 was when I met this very charming or charismatic man. I was introduced to him by some common friends. At 18, I was pretty much the opposite of what I was when I was a kid. I was starting to get rebellious. I wanted to, spend more time outside the house, getting and becoming friends with people who were twice my age, getting into relationships, like wherever I was able to get that attention, care, and love, I was just going. And at that point, I was pretty much a wreck, and people could see that, oh my God, like she is looking for love and attention, and she's all over the place. Family's broken. We need to do something to help her out. And these friends were like, "What, this guy? And he's been to Bible college, and he's gonna, I think you should speak to him because he could really help you, and he could counsel you, and you can talk about what's going on at home and about these broken relationships that you're having." And so I meet him, and he's, as I said, charismatic. This quite mysterious thing about him, and didn't really talk to me as much at first. But then once we started talking, it was like love bombing all the way. So he would be like, "Hey, do you want to go out for dinner? Or can I make you dinner? Or do you want to go here with me? Or can I pick you up?" Or he'd just show up at my doorstep and say, "Let's have lunch together and watch a movie." And then I think within a matter of weeks, he said, "Well, I have feelings for you." And I'm like, "Oh." And for the first time in my life, I wasn't inclined to this person. And I was like, I don't have feelings for him. Well, usually that would never be the case. I would always be like, "Oh my God, you like me," and dive right into the relationship. But this time, I don't know what was it, but I didn't want to get into a relationship with this guy. And I said no a couple of times, but he got upset about it, and he made me feel like he invested time in me and took me out and spent time with me and yada yada yada. And he was like, "At least give it a chance." He was so convincing that finally I said to myself, "Okay, well, let me give it a chance. And if it doesn't work out, I can always get myself out of it." And little did I know that that was not going to happen, that I was not going to be able to get myself out of it. It was, things started just moving really fast. The love bombing was still continuing. Showering me with lots of gifts. But as he was doing that, he was also manipulating me or grooming me in a way that he would say, "Well, why don't I buy you some clothes? Let's go shopping." But the whole point of him taking me shopping was that he didn't like what I was wearing. He thought it was too immodest. And so he wanted to buy me clothes that were culturally and religiously acceptable to him. But he didn't put it that way. He did it in this form. So it was very well played out. And then he'd say, "Why do you wear makeup? You look beautiful without makeup." But the whole point was that in his opinion and in his culture, makeup was seen as something as maybe sinful, or you're too full of yourself, so we don't wear makeup where we come from. And it's like, I don't want you to wear makeup too. But he puts it across as, "You look beautiful without makeup." And then came to the jewelry, and it's like, why do you need jewelry? Don't you think that if we wear jewelry and we start to be so obsessed with materialistic things, like it was just one after the other that was like, do this, don't do this, do this, don't do this. And they had really good reasoning behind it. He was, he had all the explanations in place. And at 18, I'm just like, okay, this sort of naive person who's wondering if this is a whole bunch of crap or is it real? But at that point, I'm not trusting my gut at all. I'm just like, he must be right. He's this person who went to Bible school, becoming a pastor. He's got to be right. I'm full of crap, full of shit. So let's just listen to him. He's got my best interests in mind. And so I listen. I keep listening. Then he starts isolating me from my friends, buys me a new SIM card, says, why don't you use the SIM card from now on? Your friends are a bad influence. I don't think you should be spending time with your dad because, he's an alcoholic and I can see how it's impacting you. So he said some of the right things there. And I was like, yeah, it is impacting me, So, and then he's like, your friends, well, he had some reasoning behind why they weren't good for me. And that was all his way of gaining power and control over my life. He was like, he was playing the game really well, coming in slow, And finally, at I think 19, he drops the bomb on me and he says, well, we got to get married. There was no proposal. There was no, will you marry me? There was nothing. There was just more like, we've got to get married because you know who I am. I am now a pastor. And in my society, in my culture, I can't be seen going around with a lady. If I'm going around with someone, she's got to be my wife. And at the point, I'm just like, what in the world are you talking about? Like, I am 19 years old and I've completely broken down because I'm just looking at the situation in my house and I'm like, it is hell here. And I'm looking at this person telling me that I need to get married to him, but I'm already sensing that is a different kind of hell because certain things have started to happen. And in the recent past, leading up to that conversation, there were things like him, verbally abusing me, responding to friends getting in touch with me by road rage. So if a friend would call, he would start getting into the car, tell me to get in the car, and he would be driving recklessly and threaten to hit another car to endanger us. Or this one time where I wore earrings, he hit his head like he self-harmed. So he hit his head against the window a couple of times in the car to harm himself so that I would agree to never wearing jewelry again.
Okay, I'm gonna allow myself to interrupt. What?
Yeah.
I'm just gonna 1 minute. He would get angry if you got a phone call from a friend.
Yeah.
He would ask you to get into the car,
Yeah.
make a scene about that.
Yep.
Then once you wore earrings he didn't like. Or what?
Yeah. He didn't want me to wear jewelry at all.
Okay, so I'm so confused. So he started harming himself as
Yeah.
a way to get you to stop wearing those earrings.
Yeah.
What in the actual wackadoodle noodle is that? That seems so out of. I mean, that's not healthy, normal behavior.
Yeah. Yep. That isn't, that's, that is, when I look back, I'm just like, Anna, what were you thinking? thinking, and how could you not see this as a sign of get the fuck out of here? And if you saw me back then, I was this person who was just afraid, and if I was not going to run away, but I was just afraid, and I was like, yes, I'll do whatever you say. And I have no idea where that came from. I don't know where that little Anna came from that said, I know this is unacceptable, but I am scared, and I will do whatever you say because I do not want to upset you, because in upsetting you, I put myself in danger. And even the thought of breaking out of that relationship felt dangerous at that point, because I'd seen to what extent he was going to, harm himself or threaten me. That saying no felt like a really, really hard thing to do for me. And so just kind of acclimating or appeasing him seemed like the easier thing to do. And I could see that when I appeased him, everything was okay. And the thing that came into my mind was that, Anna, you're the one who's doing things wrong. You see, when you listen to him, everything's okay. And when you don't listen to him, things aren't okay because you're making him angry and you're not doing things right. And this is why your life has been a shit show with your other relationships, because you never do anything right. So this is a person who is who is charismatic, who has been to Bible school. He's a spiritual leader in his own right. It's not possible that he wants to harm you, and maybe he has an anger issue. And that whole thing of maybe he has an anger issue came up for me because I saw my dad being violent at home. And then the next day I'd see my mom and dad, just talking and going about their lives. And so me seeing a man hit his head on the window was like, yeah, this isn't good. Like, I've seen something like this at home. But it wasn't alarming to me. It
No.
was scary, but it wasn't like, what the fuck is this?
Yeah.
That response wasn't coming out of me. It almost felt like I upset him. He's hurt. He's doing things like this. He's got an anger problem. I've angered him, and I should not do this again.
Yeah, you're blaming.
That's,
Yeah, sorry, I interrupted.
I was blaming myself.
Yeah. And also your childhood programming, you're programmed to this is just how it is. This is how people function. This is how relationships are because of the dynamic you saw between your mother and father, right? I was programmed the same way. So even though our gut is telling us this is very uncomfortable, this can't be right, then there's just that programming, and especially when you're so young and so impressionable by our surroundings, the people in our lives, we are so quick to dismiss our guts and go by our program. And then when we come out of the fog, as I like to call it, that's when we are like, what the fuck was I thinking? It was so obvious that this person was absolutely insane. What was I thinking? Why didn't I go before? Why didn't I leave? I get that.
And so, 19, I actually got married to him,
Wow.
where I was like, I literally chose between my home. It was me choosing which was a better hell.
Yeah.
It was literally that. It was like, do I continue here? And I knew this hell all too well, and I was like, done with it. And here I'm like, if I agree to what he says, if I dress the way he wants me to dress, I talk to the people he wants me to talk to, at least I'll be taken care of. At least I'll have peace. At least I'll be in a new environment and not be in this environment. And so I did that. And if I'm being honest, I was also scared of saying no to him. So all of that put together, where it's like fear of saying no and trying to like put the pros and cons between the two different hells, this somehow won in my books. And so we got married, and I think that was like the biggest mistake of my life, because 1 month into the marriage, that love bombing and manipulation and all that being in my face turned into negligence, because he's like, "Well, I got you now, and I don't need to play any games. I don't need to woo you or control you because you're my wife." And it started with this one day where I was cleaning my cupboard and there was a phone charger, and I was on a stool and I didn't have anywhere to keep it because I was reaching out to this, cabinet on top. So what I did is I just threw it behind me so it would land on the bed. And unfortunately, it hit him or hit his face. I don't know what happened. And as soon as I came down, he like slapped me across the face and said, "Don't you ever do that again to me." And I was just baffled. And I'm just like, what just happened here? Because I just meant to, throw it to the bed because I didn't have anything around me, and it mistakenly hit you for whatever reason. And you think that I purposely did it, or I don't know, what are you thinking? And he just did that and left the room, and I was just shocked, shell shocked for a couple of minutes. And I could see the demeanor and his way of behaving, the negligence. Everything was starting to change. It was like I was seeing an added side here. And then there was this one day that I went to my friend and I said, "I think I made a big mistake. I don't think I belong in this marriage. I don't think I belong in this family. I cannot adapt to their culture. I cannot adapt to their religious beliefs and ways, their requirements. I can't deal with him. He's starting to be violent and abusive." And unfortunately, that friend went and told another friend, and it came back to my husband. And as you can imagine, that's when it started getting crazy. The first thing he did that night, I remember that was the first, I would say, monumental memory that I have of how the abuse escalated. Like, he s took my phone, he smashed it against the wall, and he turned up the music. And if it's too much, you can totally cut it out. They turn up the music, and so that the people in the house couldn't hear what's going on in the room, and he starts belting me and hitting me and abusing me and saying things to me and saying, "Are you trying to destroy our marriage? Are you trying to destroy my reputation? You will never have a phone again. You will never speak to anyone again about what's happening in this house or between you and me." And I was so in shock that I couldn't scream. I was speechless, that nothing could come out of my mouth. And I was just there frozen, and I'm just shaking, and I'm like, what is happening? I couldn't even cry. And then it was a couple of hours when I hit the bed that I started to cry, and I started to process it, and I started to get scared, and I started to say, "Oh my God, what have I done? What have I got myself into? How do I get myself out of the situation?" And the next day he just said, "Well, I'm sorry that happened, but it's you who made me react that way. You shouldn't have talked about our marriage to your friend. And if you don't do that, then everything should be fine." It was never something about What's going on? What are you feeling? How can we make this better? No, it was about, you can't do this. My reputation's on the line. That's it. And from that day forward, it was about me surviving and trying to get out of that situation. There was nothing else.
Does a part of you feel you're at a standstill healing from your CPTSD symptoms due to feelings of unsafety, embarrassment, unworthiness, and powerlessness? Hi, everyone. My name is Julia Wiedemeyer, and I'm a trained professional counselor who works as an integrative somatic trauma therapist. And I have unlocked for myself the transformative power of embodied somatic polyvagal daily practices to re-regulate my nervous system, releasing stored emotions and unlocking the energy I needed to create a purposeful and thriving new future for myself. If you want to learn these practices for your own healing journey, I have an exciting offer for this podcast listening audience. Go to my website at innervisionresources.com and choose the 90-minute intensive integrative somatic trauma therapy session, usually a $175 US value for only $125 when you book your appointment using my sliding scale option. Our essential focus during this initial session will be on your unique unburdening needs, both emotionally and energetically, for you and your system, establishing whole person healing that not only nourishes your mind, body, and spirit, but also your life. So please visit my website at innervisionresources.com today to take advantage of this limited time offer ending on December 31st. I also invite you to join my online healing community at InnerVision Resources on Instagram. Have a beautiful and healing day.
And by then, he started showing even other tendencies of abusive tendencies, which is where he started taking a young girl into his like under his wings. She was a girl who lost her mom to cancer, and he started grooming her. And we had a lot of young people around us because he was a youth pastor, and so she was just one of them. But the catch here was that he was using her to spy on me. And so he groomed her. He said, "Well, I need you to help me with this something." And he cooked up a really good story and he cried some good tears in front of her. And she agreed to do whatever he wanted. And re in return, he gifted her things. If she wanted a phone, he got her a phone. If she wanted to go to the movies with us, she went to the movies with us. She had everything given to her that she was denied of in her real life. As long as she would report back to him on anything that was done by me that was not okay. Like if I picked up the phone to call somebody, if she overheard me talking to somebody about something, that was it. I would be on the receiving end. Of course, that relationship ended up being a relationship. She was a juvenile at the time, less than 18 years old. He was physical with her. Things were going down south, but she would never talk about it. She would sometimes be sleeping in between us on our bed. His parents were concerned about it. I was like, "What is going on here?" But he sold it so well. He was like, "You know, she's just one of the girls in our youth group, and she's lost her mom, and so I need to be there for her. And Anna's the one who's, you know, actually she's close to Anna. not me. So we need to do this for her. And everyone bought it. Everyone bought it. And that's when I started talking to my mom. And I said to her, I need to come back home. I can't do this anymore. And that was the second time that my mom rejected me and said, no, well, you got married. You got to stick it out, like how I stuck it out with your dad. And you got yourself into this. So you have to work it out somehow. There's got to be a solution to working it out. So abuse is normalized here. And the one hope that I had was gone. I was like, okay, mom's not going to help me. Who the hell is going to help me? Because I'm isolated from all my friends. It's just the church folks. I don't know. And my passport was kept under lock and key with his father. I was never given a house key to our apartment. I didn't have a bank account. I didn't have health insurance. I wasn't allowed to work. I wasn't allowed to go back to school. There were phases in those 6 years where I had a phone or I didn't have a phone. I had a laptop. My laptop was monitored. Who I was chatting with, who I was emailing, what websites I was visiting. And of course, I didn't know that he was doing all of this. So there were going to be points where I would get into trouble and he would catch me doing something that was unacceptable to him, whether it was confiding in somebody about what was going on, whether it was calling up a friend to tell them, I need to get out of here. He would catch on to it sometimes. And from the verbal abuse to the physical abuse, the next step was to punish me through sexual abuse. And it was like, okay, you're not going to stop. You're trying to get out of this marriage. You're not scared that I'm hitting you. So let's amp this up. I'm going to get you pregnant so that you're trapped in this marriage and there's no way out of this. And he actually said those words to me, said it to me a couple of times, that I'm going to get you pregnant and you're stuck. You're trapped. You can't get out of this. And I don't know. Like, I think in those 6 years, probably he forced himself on me about three times,
He
but I
raped
never got. Thank you for saying that word.
you. I'm sorry.
That's okay. But to my good fortune, I never got pregnant. And I'm so grateful for that. Because I was terrified of being pregnant with his child, and I knew that would be all the more difficult to get out of that situation.
Yeah.
And I think by 2010, I was this stick, anemic, pale. I think I was a size zero. I wasn't eating properly. He started buying me alcohol, which is a taboo in, church culture, in his church culture. But he would buy me alcohol because if I drank alcohol, then sex would be easy. I wouldn't
Yeah.
fight back as much. So he'd be happy to have me drink at that point. I wouldn't shower for days. I would wear the same thing. I was a disaster. I would have scars on my body, and if I showed my mom would say things like, "Do you want me to talk to him? Do you want me to tell him not to hit you?" No, I don't want you to do that because if you do that, he's going to hit me even more. And then I tell people at the church, and they're like, But he's a pastor. Like, how could he possibly be doing that to you? Well, he is. And then they would go to him and be like, have this meeting be like, we heard that, you're abusing, or not even we heard. Do you abuse your wife? Would be the question. And he just knew, though, this question is being asked because Anna has said something to somebody. And then again, we go back home, and it's another round of abuse. He would make me send emails to these church leaders and say, I lied. My husband didn't do anything to me. Just to, keep his reputation intact. There were times where he has faked cried, and said, my wife is a horrible person, and I don't know why she's doing this to me, blah, blah, blah. And I couldn't believe it. I really couldn't believe it. Finally, I'd given up all hope. I was like, I'm going to die in this house. And I think by 2010, I had attempted to take my life twice, and it didn't work. And clearly, it didn't work because I'm still here.
Thank God for that.
And when I did attempt to take my life, no one ever took me to the hospital. I swallowed a bunch of pills. I was sick for a week. I was in bed for a week, but no one took me to the hospital. One time, I tried to drink myself to death. And my plan was to have the medication afterwards, but I passed out before I could take the meds. And when I woke up, he said it would have been better if you had died.
Wow, I am absolutely blown away by this. All I can say is I'm so sorry. You just did not deserve any of that. I'm so sorry, and I'm so proud of you for you sitting here. You're looking so beautiful. I know what you have accomplished. I know that you are changing so many lives, and that requires immense strength and courage because he beat you down. And this motherfucker, just to say as it is, completely unfiltered, he had everyone wrapped around his finger because he was a bloody pastor. And this is why I don't give a fuck about titles. I don't care if you have a PhD. I don't care if you're a doctor. I don't care what your title is. I care about your morals. I care about patterns. I care about your hearts. You can show your title because so many abusers hide behind their fancy titles. Okay?
Agreed 100%. Agreed. So 2011 came, and this lady came into church. She was a domestic violence survivor herself. I took my last bet and said, I think I'm going to tell her. And if I tell her and nothing works out, that's it. And miraculously, she believed me. She understood to the T. And she said, Anna, you need to get out of this, because if you don't, he's going to kill you, or you're going to kill yourself. And I said, yes, that's what I want. I want to get out of this, but I don't know how to get out of it because I'm alone. I do not know what my rights are in a country that I am not a citizen of. I am basically a resident in this country. I don't know the laws. I don't know if I'll be sent back home. I don't know if he'll pull a stunt at the police station and say, well, she's lying. Or, I have call records of her talking to a guy, confiding him in him, or claim that I've slept around with somebody when clearly I don't think I have time to do that or even means to do that. So I didn't know. And so I wasn't going to risk going to local authorities. My passport was under lock and key, and I had been hiding some money under my bed. So in 6 years, I think I managed to save 5,000 dirhams. I don't know how much that is in pounds or dollars, but that's not very much. And then there was this point where I would start going to his parents' bedroom where my passport was, and I would keep doing passport runs. So what I'd do is when he wasn't home, or his mom was in the kitchen watching TV and his dad wasn't home, I'd do this quick thing of from my room, I'd go to their bedroom, I'd go to the drawer, I'd find the key, I'd open the drawer, I'd see my passports there, be like, okay, it's there. Close the drawer, go back to my room, time myself and say, okay, it took me this much time to get to my passport. And I tried to do that as frequently as possible because I wanted to muster up the courage to get my passport in a short span of time if the opportunity came about that I could do that and leave. And that was so scary. That would always be like, who's coming?
Yeah.
But I'd say God is so good that there came a day where he asked me, that's my ex-husband asked me that, we need to apply for a US visa because we've got to go to a conference in the States. So let's book an appointment for you to get your visa. And I was like, okay. And clearly he didn't want me to go with him to that conference because he didn't give me any documentation, supportive documentation. He didn't give me any bank account or any bank statements. He gave me nothing. He just said, here's my passport with my US visa on it. And you can tell the lady that your husband has a visa. And so you should get a visa too. In my head, I'm like, what are you talking about? I'm not so stupid. But I just did what he said. Of course, I went to the counter and the woman just asked me if I was like, what was I thinking? And she's like, do you think that you need to come here for an appointment? Just because, and think you get a visa because your husband has a US visa. And she's like, rejected. And I go back home and everyone's pissed because they're like, especially his dad's like, what were you thinking to not go with any financial statements? Blah, blah, blah. Go again and get another appointment. This time my passport's with me. And I go and go to the computer. Book another appointment. There is an appointment slot available a couple of days or 1 week. I can't remember specifically, but there was a slot available. I didn't pick that. I picked a slot, I think about 2 to 3 weeks ahead. Because in my mind, I was like, let me keep that buffer period, and maybe this period would be a time for me to get out of this. And nobody asked me for my passport in those 2 weeks. Maybe they forgot about it. Maybe they were like, anyway, she has to go for an appointment, like whatever. And that's when I told my friend, I've got my passport. Here's the money. I started giving her my documents, my important documents and clothes, whatever I could. And I said to her, I am shit scared. If you don't help me, I'm not going to get out of this. I'm going to stay put because I'm scared. And I said, please plan this for me. Please plan my getaway. Please. I will do whatever you tell me to do. I will follow the instructions, but I cannot think. I cannot be logically thinking here and planning this out because I am terrified. And so she went, she booked my ticket with the money I gave her. She bought me some essentials. And she said to me, Anna, I've booked a ticket for this date. It's on a Friday, and Friday is when we have church services. She was like, it's on a ch church day, and this is where you're going. And she had called up some nonprofits in India, because obviously I wasn't reaching out to anyone in the local authority. I didn't want to be in the same country as him in case he could pull strings. And there was one nonprofit that responded, and they said if Anna could make her way to Delhi, then we will help her. And so she said, I booked your ticket to Delhi, and this time, this is what you got to do. That day came. I didn't sleep the previous night, as you can imagine. In the morning, I tried to pull a stunt and say, I'm sick, I can't go to church. He didn't buy it. He said, I don't care, you've got to come with me. I'm like, okay. While he was having a shower, I took my laptop, I screwed it up by, I don't know what I did, but I crashed the laptop so that all of the information would be gone. I did it with a C. I don't know what I did, but I did something. And I did a pretty good job at it without knowing what I was doing. And then I went to church. I had my passport in my pocket. That's it. I go to church as I normally do. I'm sitting in the front seat as I usually am. I'm waiting. I know what time I'm supposed to go out to the back. I'm waiting for the time. Heart's beating, heart's pounding. Suddenly my husband goes missing. I'm like, where the fuck is this man? And I ask a friend, I'm like, where is he? And they're like, I don't know where he is. I can't find him. And I'm just like, oh my good God. Like, what if I walk out and I bump into him? And I waited 5 minutes. I'm like 5 minutes beyond the time I'm supposed to get out. And I'm like, fuck this. I'm going. I'm going to pretend like I'm going to the bathroom. If he's there, he's there. If he's not there, I go out the door. And I went out and he wasn't there. I got out the gate. I went to the back. There was a car. I got into the car. I got dropped off to the airport. I went into the car and I don't know what I was saying. I was rambling words. I was crying. I was just delirious. I went to the airport. I checked in. I kept looking back a thousand times and I'm like, he's coming. He's gonna come. He's gonna come. I pass immigration. He's gonna come. I go to the boarding gate and I'm taking an Emirates Airlines flight. And I say the name of the flight because this Emirates Airlines is never known to have delayed flights. But my flight got delayed by an hour that day. And I was like, holy fuck. I am waiting. I'm waiting. I'm waiting. I get on that flight, despite it being delayed, and I take off. And I am bawling on the flight. I am just weeping because I'm like, I can't believe I'm on this flight. I can't believe I did this. And at the same time, there was this guilt of what have I done? Like, what are my parents going to think? They're going to be so worried about me. What is the church going to think? They're going to be so disappointed. I have broken a church. Like all of these things are I'm thinking about it. And I'm like, but in hindsight now, I'm like, girl, weren't you thinking about yourself?
You are such a badass. You fled from a complete crazy person. You are saving your life. And that you saw a moment. This is it. It is now or never. And you did it. And I'm sitting at the edge of my chair and not breathing because I was so excited. So you say, did she board the plane? Did she not? Obviously you did, or else you wouldn't be here. But my God, and I have tears in my eyes. Jesus, the level of stress you must have gone through, and just, pure anxiety and like, is he gonna catch up with me? Is he gonna find out? Is he gonna show up? I can, wow. Oh my God.
That was one hell of a ride.
Oh my goodness.
So once I got to Delhi, I got in touch with the organization and everything worked in my favor, in all honesty, because I got a lawyer pro bono. I got a place to stay. I was not in a position to get into a full-time job because I was still, traumatized. There's so much I needed to deal with, but I needed to survive. And I had the help of certain friends, but it was still not enough for me to get by. And so I asked the organization, I'm like, can I please work for this organization? Because right now this is my safe place and I cannot, I don't think I can fit into a corporate job right now. I do not have the bandwidth for it. And they finally agreed to a very small salary, and I accepted it. There was some time that I had to take to build my confidence back up because it was pretty much the first permanent job that I was ever working. I started to notice the symptoms of CPTSD setting in. I didn't know it was CPTSD, but I could see that I was having nightmares. I was scared. I was having anxiety. I was depressed. I was having flashbacks. All of it that you can possibly think of was happening to me, and it was starting to affect my everyday life. I would think of going out to the mall, but then suddenly I would be hit with this wave of depression, and I'd be in my clothes and go back to bed and stay in bed the whole day. Or I'd go to work, and there'd be this task I was given, and I'm just like shaking because I'm just like fear, fear, fear. I had issues with figures of authority, like you had a manager in front of me, or I had any kind of figure of authority around me that I had to work with. I was scared of them, even if there was nothing to be scared of. And then finally, I got help. In about 2013, I went to see a psychologist. I started talking about my story and experience. Therapy wasn't enough, and so I went to see a psychiatrist, and that's when I started getting on medication. I got on Zoloft, put on a bunch of different meds, and then finally I found the right one for me. I've been on medication ever since. So it's been like about 10 to 12 years that I've been on medication. That saved my life, if I may say. And while I was at the nonprofit, it was a nonprofit that really empowered me to turn my pain into purpose. Because when I came there, my story shocked them. And the fact that I made my way to Delhi, they didn't think that I would make it. Like who would go to another country and get help? So they're like, wow. And in India, a lot of people don't talk about their stories. It's more of a shame. It's more of a taboo. There's a lot of stigma around domestic violence. If you've been through something like that, you shut up and you sit down and you don't talk about your failed marriage or anything of that sort. People are scared, women are scared. And I was one of the few people who was like, when asked, would you share your story that and if it would help someone else, would you do it? And I was like, yes. And they're like, okay. So every inquiry that came into the nonprofit where a domestic violence survivor had to share their story, I'd be number one on the list because I was the only one willing to share my story. And so I started sharing my story with, I started my first interview with BBC Radio. And I was trembling like a little girl. And my voice was, I don't know, the volume of like five, like you could hardly hear me. I'm like, this is my first interview. You put me on BBC.
Wow.
And then slowly I started building that confidence, and sharing my story when I could see the expression on people's faces. And they're like, wow, did you do that? And how did you do that? And I'm like, okay, I feel b validated here. I feel like I've done something that is to be proud of. And I just kept going. Meanwhile, my ex-husband and my mom together filed a missing person report on me. Because my mom at that point was brainwashed by my ex-husband, as expected, and she supported him. And so the plan was that We go and put a missing persons report, and I get my wife back, and you get your daughter back. So they did that. Thankfully, because I was associated with the nonprofit, they couldn't get to me. So they went to the cops called the organization, and the director said, "This is a case of domestic violence. She's not going anywhere." And that was it. And I had written to the embassies and the consulate, whatever I had to do, and I'd said, "I have left of my own accord. Nobody has kidnapped me. I've not gone missing. My husband abused me, and therefore I have left with my own consent, so that in case he reached out to the UAE embassy in India or reached out to the Indian consulate in UAE, he couldn't get to me that way because I already filed in my papers." And once his dad found out that I put in all those papers, he was out. He was enraged. And he said to my mom, "Again, you can cut this off if you want to." He said, "Your daughter is a prostitute. And she fucked my son's life. And do you know what's going to happen?" And he himself is a pastor, by the way. He's like, "Do you know what's going to happen to my son? Like, he could get deported." And my mom's just there, like, just listening to him. And I got told a story because my dad was there as well. And my dad and I got close after he came out of rehab for his alcoholism. And I was just baffled. And my mom kept sending me emails and she's like, "Where are you? You need to come back. You are my baby. I need to bring you back." But all of that was sent to me with this intent of taking me back to that marriage and not back to my home where she would protect me. And so I wouldn't give in. I was like, I would give back in those emails. I'm like, "If you were my mother and if I was your baby, you would protect me. You would have been there for me. I wouldn't have had to go to this, this end to be here. I wouldn't have had to go through all this trouble, all this pain, all of these challenges, leave the country and come here." But to her, it was more like, "You left the country and you are such a shame to society. How could you leave like that? What will people say?" I'm like, "I don't care what people says because nobody was there for me. Nobody's here protecting my life, so they're not doing anything for my life. Why should I give a shit?" I went no contact with her for a little while, because she was still going to the church. They were just not happy that I had left, that I got into a relationship as well. And they were like, "Oh, you left this marriage because you wanted to get into a relationship." I'm like, "Yes, yeah, okay. Say whatever you want to say. I don't give a shit." And finally, I started getting more empowered by seeing all of this hate and diplomacy from people. There were people who were like, "Oh, we want to know what happened, but we don't want to help you." And then there are people who are just standing there and like saying nothing. And then there's just a handful of people who, even if they associated with me, they didn't want the world to know that they were associated with me because they didn't want to be in his bad books or get into trouble with him for being in touch with Anna. And come 2014, the girl who he was, grooming or having—I would never say that she was to blame. I will always say he was to blame because she was really young. And though it all turned into an affair, like she was 16 at the time, and then by the time I left, I think she was post 18. He dumped her for her friend, which was expected, and she reached out to me and said, "Anna, this is what's happened." And she just said to me everything that I thought I was imagining when I was with him about the both of them. And she confirmed everything that I thought was going on. And it was, as much as it was devastating to hear her say those things, it was also heartbreaking to hear what he had done to her and the amount of pain he had inflicted on her and the trauma he had inflicted on her at such a young age. And at the same time, it was also freeing to know that Anna, finally got some closure here. Because all this time you were wondering, you were in the dark, you were being gaslit. When you approached him about certain things, he was denying it and he was abusing you, and you're wondering if you were the crazy woman. And now you know, it's come right out of the horse's mouth. She's told you that whatever you thought was going on was indeed going on. And I mean, that was another victory in itself. For me to just have this person who was with him also be free of his abuse. And people often ask me, like, how can you speak to her? Because she used to spy on you and she was in a relationship with your husband and she is an awful person. And I always tell them, I'm like, yes, she did do those things and she did hurt me, but she was a minor when it all began. And
She's a child. I mean,
yeah, she was a child. She was groomed. She was properly groomed. She was told what to do. And if I blame anyone or if anybody's responsible for what she did, it's him. It's him. And I'm like, I can easily forgive her with a snap of a finger because I understand how this whole thing works.
She was a victim too. You were both victims.
It's absolutely. And not a lot of people see that, by the way. Not a lot of people see that. To this date, she is also an outcast where she is not believed. So the world is blind. And abusers continue to, I would say, deceive people really, really well. It is, I think, Oscar worthy, if I may say.
Absolutely. The how they do it, I've experienced it multiple times. I don't know how they get away with it, but they get away with it, and they are, boy, are they good at it, because they leave you looking like you are the one that's a complete nutter, and they are the same one. And they do it effortlessly. I don't know
Absolutely.
how, but they do.
So that's been a journey ever since, just been sharing my story, working for the nonprofit, crowdfunding for some of their projects that had to do with supporting domestic violence survivors. Elderly women who were going through abuse and were being abandoned. I found my, I really found my passion. I found myself saying this is what I'm meant to do. I'm meant to help people. And this drive of what I've been through is going to help me make this change. And so I was just doing things in whatever capacity that I could. At one point, I was heading my own department in the nonprofit as a communications officer. So I was, handling all of the communications and fundraising and all of that. It was very, very, very empowering. Doing a lot of podcast interviews, getting featured in newspapers. At some point, for Women's Day, I got felicitated as one of the women of substance. I mean, when I look back, I'm like, oh my gosh, this is a dream. But none of those awards mean anything. As much as sharing my story means to me. I see those moments as, okay, this is a platform for me. For people to see me so that I can share the story so that other people can hear it and women can get empowered and know that they're not alone. Like this award, it just serves that purpose.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so that's how it continues. And then Brave and Free came. I just started continuing to do the work in my own little way, in my small ways, and then it keeps growing. Opportunities start coming your way. I then said I want to make a more tangible difference. And so I got my coaching certification in place. And so now I am a integrated mental health and trauma recovery coach. I became a mental health first aider, doing some partnerships with mental health clinics here in Dubai, and of course on the community advisory board for Healing and CPTSD Community Hub, which has been my most recent milestone. And I'm loving it because I get to host a domestic abuse support circle, which has been one of my little dreams to do that. So I guess that's how the journey has sort of made its way, and I'm excited for all that is to come and what more I can do with my story. And in all honesty, it's in doing these things that helps me get up every day, because the symptoms of trauma and CPTSD are not easy to deal with and not easy to live with, and I struggle with it till date, even though I'm on medication. But this purpose is what gives me the strength and the joy to show up every day and be like, I've got to show up. There are people out there who need me. And that's what I do. Yeah.
And I'm sitting here with tears in my eyes, and I am in awe of you, and it's always an honor to meet a fellow survivor who has made the conscious choice. You know what? I am not going to let this define me. I am going to turn my pain into purpose. That is what I'm all about. That is why my name is Miss Trauma Alchemist. It's about turning the shit into gold, into whatever that's meaningful for the individual. I'm not saying that everyone has to show up and be a coach, have a podcast, write a book, but definitely turning that shit around to something good. I think it's so important that we do that, because I believe that that sense of purpose, that is what keeps us going. Because as you just said, living with CPTSD, it's debilitating. Let's just say as it is. I'm not on medication, but I am in therapy every single week, sometimes several times a week. Sometimes I'm bouncing off the walls.
Same.
I suffer greatly with flashbacks. It's not bloody easy. This
Correct.
is a very, very challenging, ch challenging path, and it's
Yeah.
not for the faint of heart. I'm just so incredibly proud of you, and I for some reason I feel like saying congratulations. Like, you did it. You fled. You got through it. And you alchemized it. You alchemized your pain. I know that you live with the debilitating consequences. I know that that is true, but it's also true that you did manage to alchemize, and now you get to be the facilitator for other women. And how beautiful is that? I
Thank
mean,
you.
I, my goodness, I have just, can we just. It's just beautiful. Brings tears to my eyes. And I can't wait for us to, well, I'm not going to say that on the podcast, but you know what I'm referring to when I say that,
Yet.
to collaborate more in the future in whatever ways we can. As I have questions for you, but first I want to know, is there anything else from your story you would like to share? I'm a little bit curious, I will admit, to know how could you go from that absolute hell that almost killed you to going into a new relationship, and now you're happily married. I'm so curious about just how did you do that? Because I am absolutely terrified of men, terrified because of my experiences with men, mainly as a child.
Well, honestly, I failed on that path quite a bit until, or rather, I'm still getting it right, because there was a tendency for me to keep getting into relationships even after, I got out of the marriage. I got into a relationship pretty damn quickly, and all of it was just like a rebound where it's like I get myself into another abusive relationship, as you mentioned, that you fear getting yourself into. And what I've learned is that if you don't take time for yourself to, number one, rediscover who you are, it's like, who is Anna? Who is Jasmine? Because you've been through so much of trauma where all you've done is survive. And you never thought about what's your favorite color or what's your favorite food. It's more like, how the heck do I get through this day or this moment? And so you've never thought about these things that everyone else who's not been through this have been thinking about. So the first step is to think about, who am I? What are my values? What am I looking for in a relationship? And it takes some time because none of that is in your head. And you probably can't even find the words, feelings, emotions to describe any of that. And so one is giving myself time. I would have given myself even more time, but I wasn't as well informed as I am today. But at least I am today. And the second thing is to also have this understanding that being in a healthy relationship doesn't mean that if there is no abuse, it is healthy. What I mean to say is that no abuse does not constitute a healthy relationship, because that's what happens. When I got out of that marriage, I was like, okay, what am I looking for here? No abuse. No abuse. No abuse? Sorry, not happening. No abuse? Happening. But that's not what a relationship is about. Yes, no abuse is the basic there, right? Like love and respect, no abuse is the basic. And then you've got to look at compatibility. You've got to look at what are the things you want in a relationship. And not the typical stuff like, I want him to be understanding, but more like, okay, I need this guy to be financially sound, or he needs to be, I want him to take care of me, or I want to have the same emotional, he should have the same emotional intellect as I do. Think about all of those things and take time to get to know that person enough to see if he has all of those things that you actually want in a relationship. Because time, honestly, I wouldn't say time heals, but time tells a lot.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah. So I would say time is a great information giver. And to take the time, take as much time as you want to get to know yourself and get to know that person. I think that's the way to, getting into healthier relationships and making yourself aware of what is a healthy relationship, whether it means learning about that in therapy, or, seeing other couples or other people in healthy relationships, exposing yourself to that, because we were never modeled that.
Exactly. We were
And
not.
so now we need to know. I mean, if you've never been to Japan, you don't know what Japan looks like.
How on earth would you know? Exactly.
So it's very important to have like some kind of framework there in terms of, oh, this is actually what a healthy relationship is, and these are the basics of a healthy relationship. And once I've got that sorted, now let's talk about what I want in this relationship.
Exactly.
Yeah. So it's, I think it's more of getting out of the survival, because I think for me as a survivor, I would stick to the survival tactics or the survival qualities more like, does it tick this box and this box and this box and this box? Okay, he does. I think it's a, it's, I think we're good. But there's so much more.
There is.
Yeah.
May I add one thing that I've noticed in my own journey?
Yeah.
Fall in love with yourself.
Yes.
Fall in love with yourself first. So you
Absolutely.
know what it feels like. So you know, so you have an idea. You know, when
Yep.
you have the background that we do, it's not going to be obvious, but if you start giving that love to yourself, if you start training your nervous system, your body to notice, this is what it feels like when I'm loved. This is what it feels like to be nurtured. This is what it feels like when I feel safe in my body. Understanding the cues. I guess that's a part of understanding who is Anna, who is Jaslyn. Understanding the signs, the language of your body, and also falling in love with yourself. Because what I've noticed in my journey is the more I invest in loving myself and accepting myself, that manifests into my reality. You know, when I was completely unaware and had no sense of self-worth or nothing, I also didn't have a standard, you know, so I would just befriend everyone and everything, and I would just date everyone and everything because I didn't have a standard. I didn't have a sense of quality. I likely didn't know what it was I wanted. So, and I never had the mindset, oh, I hope I like them. No, oh, do they like me? I was so occupied and wanted to be liked and being chosen.
Yeah.
I don't have that need anymore. I'm like more concerned, do I like him? Do I feel safe around him? You know? So it's a journey, I'm
It
guessing.
is.
Even
It
when you
is.
get married, right? It's still a journey.
It still is. It still is. I
Yeah.
guess my two cents is just that don't rush into anything, especially if you come out of an abusive relationship, because there's so much unlearning to do, there's so much learning to do, there's so much self-love to do, as you mentioned, so much discovery and curiosity, because it's almost as if you're walking out into the world all over again, and you're seeing it through new eyes, because all of this time, like, you've been in darkness, and you just need to know or get adjusted to where you are.
I resonate deeply with what you said. It exactly feels like I'm a toddler again and I'm learning to walk for the first time. That's what it feels like. Going into the world with this new awareness. Okay, I have CPTSD. This is what I survived. These are the new things that I'm learning. Is there any last thing you would like to say to the listeners? Any advice, any one word or a sentence or and maybe nothing. It's up to you.
I guess more than talking to survivors, I, because I think survivors get told quite a lot, don't give up, there's light at the end of the tunnel, stay hopeful. We know all of that. And I think the people who need to be talked to are everyone else. And, that's the families and the friends. Because when a victim is in a domestic abuse situation or any kind of abusive situation, they cannot get through it without a support system. And I would be lying if I were to tell you that you can do it on your own. I mean, you may be able to do it on your own, but I think more often than not, when it comes to these things, a support system is vital. You know, when somebody comes and tells you that they're being abused, believe them. When someone comes and tells you, I need your help, help them in whatever capacity that you can. Because that might save their life. That might save them years of abuse and save them years of trauma. And that's what we need today. It's about the more you dismiss a victim, the more trauma you're adding to their life. And that road of trauma recovery is not an easy one. And it goes to parents as well. I think parents play a crucial role when it comes to this, parents or guardians. And that is how you raise your child and what you expose your child to. Because when they are in that space, their brains are getting formed. Their brains are getting used to what they see and what they hear. And it is up to you to shower them with all the love and shower them with all that sense of, I am loved and this is what I deserve, and showing them that this is what a healthy relationship is supposed to look like model things that you want them to live out when they get older. Because if you model abuse, and if you model ignorance, and if you model normalizing abuse, that's what is going to follow through for them. Because that's all they know. As kids, that's all we know. What we see is what we know. We do not have the capacity to understand beyond that as we do as adults. And so if we have that foundation set as kids, we grow up expecting that. It's like, you know, if you're told by a mom and dad, like, you are deserving of respect, you grow up and say, like, you damn well respect me. You know, I'm not going to take your shit. But if you see your mom not respecting herself, or you not getting the respect as a child, or you being neglected as a child, you grow up thinking that you don't deserve love. And so, really, my message is to everyone else but victims and survivors out there, because it's time that everyone else does something.
Absolutely. I absolutely agree with you. Our culture is so toxic, and it perpetuates the abuse of victim survivors. I've been speaking on this on my Instagram page. I even wrote a letter because I was so enraged about it. So I appreciate your words of wisdom so much. And I hope and pray, and maybe I'm one of them to do that, that more survivors will step into the arena with this message, actually not speaking to victim survivors, but speaking to our society and the toxic culture that perpetuates the victim shaming, blaming mentality.
Absolutely.
So thank you so much
Thank
for
you.
your words of wisdom. And thank you so much for being here. What a roller coaster it has been for me. Rage on your behalf to excitement. So like, oh my God, did she make it? Did she not make it? Obviously, you make it because you're bloody sitting here. But I just went through so many emotions through this episode.
Oh,
Thank you.
thank you for holding space for me and listening and for your questions. Thank you.
That was it for today. Thank you for listening. If you enjoyed this episode, please remember to rate Alchemical Voices and follow the community on Instagram. Until next time.